I'm Ellen Mary.
And I'm Michael Perry.
And he's a plonky.
And she's a plant addict.
And this is the Plant-Based Podcast.
This is more than just a gardening podcast. We'll be exploring the world of plants from every possible angle. We'll be talking about plant-based diets, plant materials and fabrics, the well-being qualities of plants, and giving plenty of gardening tips and tricks.
So we'll be chatting worldwide to companies and individuals that are being creative with plants in new and exciting ways, from fabulous flower crowns to foliage-filled lounges,
botanical moisturizers to bamboo clothing.
It's all here.
And it's all made of plants.
So we are standing by a really funky looking exhibition here at Hampton Court with Andy from Andy's Air Plants. Andy, they've become really fashionable, haven't they?
Yes, they are. Yeah, they have. They're very popular at the moment. There's such wonderful, versatile plants, and there's so many different species in the genus Tillandsia, which of course is bromeliad, which is the pineapple family. Yeah. And air plants are just one of the genera within that family.
Hold on. Okay, hold on a minute. Air plants are part of the bromeliad family, which I love, by the way. I love bromeliads. So people take the mickey out of me because I love them so much. So this is amazing news. So all of you people out there who love air plants and you've messaged me on Twitter taking the mickey, you can take it back.
Yeah, true, because a pineapple is obviously a type of bromeliad.
Exactly, yeah.
How so fabulous.
Pineapple is a terrestrial bromeliad. Right. So it grows on the ground like these Okagavias and Dickias here and things like that, are terrestrial bromeliads like the pineapple. Uh-huh. And the air plants in the genus Tillandsia are the epiphytic cousins of the pineapple, and an epiphyte, it's Latin, it means it grows on another plant. It grows up on trees, they grow on scrub bushes, they grow even on cacti and things like that. Some of the air plants are actually terrestrial, growing on sand dunes, and some of them, in deserts and things like that.
How long have you been doing this for? I mean, how long have you loved air plants?
So I've been growing and collecting air plants for nearly a decade now.
Wow.
So, but I've only been showing for about 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
And this is my second year with the RHS and first year at Hampton Court.
Yeah. It looks amazing. I mean, air plants, to me, they're something really retro. Like when I was a kid, you know, there was air plants like glued to shells and stuff that. It was all a bit, and it seemed very passé at the time, but I think everything's really developed now, and you see them in lots of different crafty creations. You can see here there's a wide range. Yeah. I mean, you've been showing me around some of these, and there's actually some that are fragrant as well, and with quite big flowers.
Oh, yeah.
So the family is very extensive, and obviously some of those are for the house as well. What are the best ones that you can grow indoors?
Okay, so there's a good set of more common and widely available species, and you can try most of them in the house, really. You've got to remember that the silvery ones and the ones with the little hairs on their leaves, which are called trichomes, are better for a sunny position. And if you've got east
silver
or west,
sun.
Silver for sun, and green, the greener ones without the hairs on the leaves, they're more suitable for shade or terrariums and things like that.
Okay, what about the one that looks like hair, the Spanish moss? Can we really grow that indoors as a house plant?
Yeah, you can. It can be a little bit sort of site specific, you know. It does like the thing about air movement, air plants is the key's in the name. They like air movement, so they like wetting, but they do like drying. It's only the real green ones like Butsii and Bulbosa that are a little bit more shade tolerant, and a little bit more tolerant of a more humid environment, whereas all the silver ones, which is most of them, they want quick drying, so air movement is the key. And that's why I always say when you're displaying them, it's better to put them on things and not in things, you know, because they like that air movement. So you can tie them onto shells and put them on arrangements and things like that, but it's best not to put them inside shells, you know, because they also make offsets, which we call pups, and they often pup from right down at the very base.
Okay. Okay.
And obviously if they haven't got the space around the base of the plant.
So can you indeed use glue if you are putting them into a display? Or?
Yeah, you can use a bit of glue. A really, really nice way to grow them, perfect for beginners, is to just grow the plant on its own. They don't need any soil, natural. They don't have to be tied onto any ornament or anything. And you can just wrap a little bit of colourful wire around them and just hang them up in your window.
Simplicity.
And then,
yeah.
Exactly. It's the best way to
grow. And what about watering then? What is the ideal way to water your air plants? Because I see a lot of different advice and I want to get that right.
Can I tell you what I do? And then you can tell me if I'm doing this right or wrong. Because I'm probably doing the same as what maybe most people are doing. I don't know. So I've got a few air plants. Some of them are in, you know, like the wire egg cups. So it's like the shape of an egg cup, but it's just wire. So they're getting lots of air, and I just sit them in it. And I've got three, and I don't know what ones they are, but they're quite big, and they look like this.
Yeah.
Very much like that. What's that one? It's a silvery one.
So silver
for
sun.
Silver for sun,
yeah. Silver for sun, that's it.
Sitting in kind of indirect light. And every now and again, when I remember, basically, I dunk them in water for about 10, 15 minutes, and I take them out, and then I let them drip dry before I put them back. Is that...
Okay-ish. Yeah, that sounds all right.
That'll do.
A quick dunk is best.
Right. Okay.
But you're right. There's a lot of misconceptions out there and a lot of misinformation out there. People are dunking their air plant for an hour or two once a week. Well, that's not how to do
it.
Really, best way is regular light misting.
Right.
So a mist gives all the leaves a light covering, because all those little hairs all over the leaves, they disperse the water amongst them, and a lot of these silver ones and the sun lovers, including some of the most widely available ones, the small ianthophores, they don't want to be dunked at all.
No.
They've got little hollows in the leaf bases, and if they fill with water, and especially if they're in a home where there's not good air movement, then they're going to stay wet for too long.
So
and
dunking's
they don't like
not
that.
Really the best advice, it's spraying.
Misting.
Put it this way, I've got thousands of them, and I don't dunk any of them.
Mm. Right. So you just missed all of them.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's
they all
good
get
to know.
Where do you keep all of them? There's so many. Your house must
I've
look amazing.
I've got a greenhouse and a polytunnel, and it's absolutely rammed with plants. Yeah.
And just one final thing then, we're really experiencing this revival of air plants. Why do you feel that is, and do you think it will continue?
I think they're just so versatile and they're really unique. They look really alien, and there's so much variety within the genus. So many different shapes and textures, beautiful colours. I just think they're at the peak of evolutionary excellence, really.
Fascinating. Evolutionary excellence.
House plant to start with as well, aren't they? Because you've got no pot, no soil.
Yeah.
You just got to spritz them with water once
a week.
That's it.
Some of the ones with the more broader leaves, they'll tell you if they're drying out too much, and that the leaves will curl in at the edges. So that's another good tip to look after your plant.
Yeah, because I love the big Xerographica one, and we'll put some pictures up of that when we release this podcast. But it's kind of almost freestanding because they can get up to like a foot wide, and you can have them almost as just a table decoration, can't you?
Absolutely.
Like with a few candles.
I've actually seen a gigantic one.
Yeah.
It's in the middle of like a coffee table.
Yeah.
And it looks stunning.
So Xerographica is a real desert plant. It's really light misting. They really don't want water to sit in the rosette.
Yeah.
So it's just misting from that one. In fact, they're hanging up in the greenhouse, facing out, and they only get misted from the back,
Looks super cool.
That's super cool. Thank you so much. Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure.
So sometimes pinks and carnations can get a reputation as being a bit of a grandma plant. And I know that my grandma grew them. But actually, you've got to open your eyes because a lot has changed. A lot of those plants are now more modern, suitable for modern gardens, stronger growing. But that still traditional fragrance is still there. And I'm here with Stephen from Kalamazag Nursery. Have I pronounced that correctly?
You've got it spot on.
Did I also get Stephen correct?
You did, Michael.
Good.
Yes.
So we're going to ask you a bit about your journey with pinks, why you started growing pinks and carnations. Basically, pinks are miniature carnations, kind of in my head. I know.
Okay, well, they're all dianthus.
Like.
They're all the same family. So carnations, pinks, sweet williams, and many, many species. Mm. So
tell us how you kind of started onto that journey of dianthus and what you're up to now.
We're a family nursery. We started three generations ago with my wife's grandparents, and they grew carnations for Cut Flower Marketplace, in Cornwall. And then my wife's dad took over, then my wife, and we've expanded into a real speciality now.
A true family business.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah. So we grow over 300 different varieties.
Wow. Okay, so your exhibition and stand here looks really beautiful. And I'm going to go with what you said, Michael. They did used to remind me of my granny, I guess. Yeah. But I saw, I think it was on Gardener's World, perhaps, but on one of the gardening shows, probably about 2 years ago, somebody was potting up an old concrete kind of trough with pinks or dianthus, and it looked so beautiful. You can't, like, they're so pretty, aren't they? Yeah. And it completely changed my opinion of them.
Right. We at the flower shows, we get an awful lot of people who come and buy off us in a sentimental way, as you said.
Yeah.
Oh, my gran, my mum, depending on the age of the customer, and I'd like some, but actually people open their eyes and they look and they think, oh, I can put them in a galvanised container, I can put them in a trough, or in a wall, or
decorative,
you know,
and vintage style as
they
well.
They are, aren't they? So they look nice with kind of grit or stone, so maybe in a dry garden.
So they need to be in very free-draining soil.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They don't want to get very, very wet in the winter.
Yep.
They want to be in a really nice sunny spot. And they'll flower and flower all summer.
That makes them easier to care for, because that is those dry, sunny banks, those awkward corners of the garden that just get baking sun all day, and also gardens where we don't want to have to water them every day or even every week, because they're pretty much going to look after themselves.
This is my garden. Yeah. This is my garden.
It's the garden everyone dreams of,
Ellen. I'm not sure about that with the slugs and snails, but I've got some really beautiful bright pink ones, and they're in a wooden crate that's been painted bright blue.
Brilliant.
So the pink and the blue they just look so beautiful. Yeah. And a couple of years ago, I would never have imagined buying them.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? And we supply a lot of people now that grow cut flowers. Mm. And their businesses are booming now. It's becoming quite a trendy plant.
Yeah.
You know, the scented garden
things
pink is getting
back.
Yeah.
But I gotta, like, where are those cut flowers going? Because when I buy flowers in the supermarket, carnation flowers, a lot of those are potentially Dutch grown that are selected for vase life over fragrance.
Yeah.
So you grab this bunch of carnations, they've got the look, but they haven't got the scent.
So you really want to be going to your local flower farm, local markets, farmers markets.
Okay.
You'll find these. You'll find scented pinks.
But you're growing also carnations, which have got the longer stems.
Yeah.
So where are you selling those into? Again, those farmers markets?
Oh, it's a mix, isn't it?
They don't get to the supermarket.
No, they don't.
It's such a shame, because you get the same thing with roses.
Yeah.
You get that vase life, but you don't get the fragrance. Yeah. And I think
it's a shame.
Yeah.
It's inexcusable. You know,
it's inexcusable. Did you hear that, everybody? Michael says so.
Really vehement about that sort of thing, you know.
So can you maybe tell us something about describe some of these to our listeners? Because they can't see what we're talking about, of course.
They can't smell them, and this is shame.
Yeah, it is a shame.
Isn't
so what about this very pretty
one?
We've got
this one called Coral Reef. It's a real beautiful coral colour, beautiful little white edges to it. It's a great scent. And this starts flowering in spring. Won't stop until frost.
Well,
it will just carry on and on.
You just deadhead, do you?
Just deadhead. Give it a bit of feed. So high potash food, so tomato food, anything like that, will keep this thing flowering and flowering.
I remember my grandma's plants. They probably lasted for 20 years or more. The same plant.
Yeah,
it just got kind of bigger, and every so often we divide it and split it, but so long-lasting.
Yeah, they are long-lasting. I mean, we generally find most of our customers will get a really good plant 3 to 5 years. You know, the plant won't die after that, but 3 to 5 years is the optimum for producing good flower.
How many plants in this container here?
So that's one plant.
That's one plant?
Yeah.
And how many flowers are here? What?
Oh, like 50? Well, I mean, if you look
at
the buds on there,
50.
Come on, we're talking 100 buds on there already.
So Coral Reef is a very beautiful dianthus.
Yeah.
And it's just had his picture taken.
And just had his picture taken.
So listeners will get to see that one. So just one more before we move on. But you pick one that you really love.
I like the supernova.
Okay, supernova.
I mean, but just because it's so vibrant.
Yeah, it is.
And again, if you look at the edges, look at the pinked edges.
Oh,
this is how pinks got their name.
Yeah. Oh, from the pinking shears.
From the pinking shears, yeah.
That's
cool.
Very, very beautiful. So I'm holding the microphone and attempting to take a photograph in the other hand because it's so pretty. Supernova. Yeah, that's really lovely. Well, thank you very much.
Right.
I hope everybody has some dianthus in their gardens now, actually.
Definitely.
Really easy plant to grow.
It's such great value, and that vintage appearance and fragrance is just second to none. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you. Nice to speak to you.
whether you recognise the name Hebe or not, you'll definitely recognise what a Hebe looks like, because they're the type of shrub you always see in the garden centre, in the DIY store, as a kind of impulse purchase. They're always kind of, you know, near the checkout, kind of there. Often seen as quite a throwaway item, and I think in recent years they've almost become as throwaway as perhaps those £2 orchids that you buy in the supermarkets as well. But we're here at Hampton Court and we've seen the Hebe Society has an amazing display with almost 30 different types of Hebe, and it really helps us explore the world of Hebe and how varied it really is. And we've got Steve Harding from the Hebe Society here to talk to about Hebes. So Hebes, like, why do they have this reputation as being this kind of like boring shrub? Because looking around here, this is far from boring.
A long time ago, a lot of the Hebes available in the UK were, in all honesty, plain green, boring leaves with white
like
or blue
flowers.
Like that
one over there, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one.
And it's still pretty though.
They are. Yeah. Bees and the butterflies absolutely adore them.
Mm.
People used to grow them at the back of a border or in a hedge. Mm-hmm. They get a bit leggy, a bit tired. And think, oh, what do we do? Oh, we'll throw it away and plant something else. But the last, as you said, the last, what, say, 10, 20 years, there have been hundreds, nearly thousands of new cultivars, varieties coming onto the market. A heck of a lot of variegated forms, which are brilliant. They're winter hardy.
Mm-hmm.
They're ideal in pots on a patio or by your front door. They're just fantastic plants. And a lot of the new variegated forms, Hebe Heartbreaker, which is small variegated leaf just there.
Yeah.
As it gets colder, all the new growth turns a brilliant purple.
Wow.
Oh, no.
And the contrast with the variegated leaf and the red and the purple in the winter, it is stunning.
Mm.
Most of them are completely hardy, down to about minus 10, minus 12.
That's a good garden shrub then.
It is.
Tough,
it
resilient,
is.
Does what it says on the tin.
Yeah. They're more or less all sun-loving plants, well-drained soil.
Mm-hmm.
If you get into Hebes, one or two of the species do like growing in waterlogged conditions.
Okay.
Uh-huh. A few and far between, as a rule.
They like to be waterlogged. Which ones?
Hebe macrocarpa is a long green leaf over there.
Okay.
Has pure white flowers in April, about 10 centimetres, 12 centimetres long. I mean, stunning white flowers. That grows in bogland, marshland in New Zealand. There are one or two others grow in streams.
It's just a whole different world from Hebe that you don't imagine, because also you've got that one that looks like a conifer.
Yes, that's called a whipcord Hebe.
James Stirling.
When Captain Cook went out to New Zealand and the botanists found that plant, they thought it was a conifer, sent it back to Kew Gardens, who rooted it, thinking it was a conifer. They thought it was a caprescus of some description.
Yeah.
Then it flowered white, and they suddenly realised, hang on a minute, as they were veronicas. They thought, that's a veronica flower.
Yeah.
Hang on a minute, let's start classifying this.
Oh, wow.
So for about the past 180, nearly 200 years, as a family of plants, they've been flitting from veronica to Hebe and now back to veronica again, to confuse everybody.
But look at some of these, like bees and butterflies love them for a start, but look at the lovely effect you get there. It's almost colour changing, isn't it?
Is.
You've got
kind of
like a pink tip and a white bottom there. It's like an ice cream, isn't it?
Oh, where's Nicholas Blush? Oh, so that's Hebe Nicholas Blush. Oh, hence the blush at the tip of the flower.
That's probably my personal favourite of all the Hebes is Nicholas Blush. Because of that plant will start flowering in early May and it will keep going. I've had it in flowering Christmas Day in my garden.
It's true. Like, I have to be honest, Hebes have never been top of my list, ever. I don't know particularly why. They just, I don't know.
Well, I think it's almost, what is it? I think it's a dichotomy. That might be the wrong word, but bear with me.
Yeah.
It's one of those plants you see planted on roundabouts in car parks.
Yeah,
so you know
do,
it's resilient.
Yeah.
But then when it comes to planting it in your own garden, you're kind of like, oh, is that a little bit too trashy? So then you overlook it.
Yeah.
But it's silly that you overlook this plant that is actually really resilient and easy to grow.
Yeah.
But that's why it's great to learn these different varieties that are just different to the ones you'd see on that roundabout.
You're right. I honestly think that is the roundabout thing.
Yeah.
You know, you see them so often out in that kind of planting and you just sort of think, well, you're not going to put that in your garden. But a friend of mine, she had loads of Hebes in her garden. I always remember her just saying, we have bees bees and butterflies like mad in our garden. And I did end up buying a hebe that I have growing in a pot, and it's fine. I don't know what one it is, but it's got lovely white flowers. And the bees do enjoy it. They do come to it. You can always guarantee there'll be bees around it. So, we have to forget the fact that they're on roundabouts. That's not what it's all about, is it? There's also iris on roundabouts and valerian on roundabouts, but we still grow those in our garden, don't we?
And they're often in those kind of new build kind of identikit gardens along with Choisya Sundance, aren't they? So you look at them with disdain most of the time, as you would things like Escalonia. But the new Escalonia, Pink Ellie?
Yes.
That's really changed things for Escalonia. Yes, so I think with some of these hebes, especially things like Heartbreaker.
Heartbreaker's brilliant.
That's really changing everything for hebes. But one thing they do that people are never sure how to deal with is when they get very big and overgrown, what is the best way to then deal with them? Can you cut them back or trim them gently? How do you deal with that?
On a hebe, when you look at the stem on a hebe, you'll see there are horizontal lines evenly spaced all the way up.
Okay.
Every one of those lines on the stem is a growth bud. So if you cut, you cut it back to just above that growth bud, in time, it will regrow.
So even if you do need to cut it back
hard? If you cut it back hard, it will regrow.
Just not below any buds.
But saying that, the smaller, compact mound-forming hebes, Hebe topiara over there, the smaller the leaf, the more fussy they are with pruning. It's just a light trim after flowering to keep it compact.
Uh-huh.
They can go a bit bare in the bottom.
Yeah.
They're the ones you see on the roundabouts with big brown patches in them.
Yeah.
Basically, in your own garden, if it starts to go, just snip that shoot out and it will reshoot straight away.
Okay, I think people are scared too.
So they're super easy to look after then, aren't they?
It's just not knowing and not being brave enough sometimes.
Yeah. We do that with many plants, though, to be honest. I have a lovely story about hebe. Another reason why I ended up with one in the garden. There's a garden called the Bishop's House Garden near where I live in Norwich. It is what it says on the tin. It's the Bishop's Garden. And they've got some beautiful plants in there and shrubs and specimen stuff. They've got this wonderful hebe. It's huge. And it was grown from a sprig taken from Queen Victoria's wedding bouquet in 1840 or something, whenever it was. And that's that hebe growing in there. And sometimes when royalty get married, they send little sprigs from that off to other bouquets. Yeah. Isn't that lovely?
Yeah, super cool.
There you go. So hebe has history too.
Yeah, hebe, another kind of overlooked plant that is now having its moment in the spotlight, which is fantastic.
It is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this is exciting because we're sitting on a massive big deck chair with Hayley from Hayley's Lottie Haven.
Yay! Not just that, she's a fan of the podcast.
Yeah, of course I am.
We've met a fan.
Yeah.
Hayley listens to it in the bath.
Yeah, it's the perfect time. Away from the other half who's not into gardening, so
yeah,
perfect time.
First things first, I'm just going to congratulate you on your recent engagement because I can see your beautiful ring and it's so lovely.
Thank you very much.
So congratulations on that. And you're here getting inspiration for some floral
stuff. Planning for the wedding, so hopefully going to grow some own flowers and see how it goes. Cool. Might be a bit of trial and error, but
That's gardening, right?
Exactly, exactly. We love it.
That would be cool. That would be so rewarding to grow your own flowers.
Definitely.
You're going to grow your own veg as well for the canapes?
I was actually going to. We are going to do our own food. So, I'm hoping to grow as much of it as possible.
Oh, do a broad bean puree.
Oh, yes. That'd be nice. Got to do that, I've got to plan the time of the year. So, it depends when we're having the wedding.
My favourite vegetable is a broad bean, by the way. What's yours?
Mine as well, but you're not a fan of them.
No, I just don't like them.
Are you a single podder or a double podder?
What do you mean?
I did double pod.
Did you?
Do I get it out the pod?
Yeah.
Not usually, but if you've got an older one, you need to.
Yeah.
But have you, I've had them in Japan where they grow them almost as like a delicacy.
Oh, really?
So you actually, I'm not sure if they're even different or they're just broad beans just dressed up as something posh. I don't know, but anyway, we weren't here to talk about broad beans, were we?
So obviously this episode's all about retro plants and we've been speaking to some really cool people, you know, about heathers and chrysanthemums, all those plants that are kind of coming back around again. And then we bumped into Hayley and we were kind of chatting about it, weren't we?
Yeah.
And we... Well, we asked the question, how you see gardening now. Mm. So coming into gardening... As a younger person,
much younger than us,
yes, having not seen it the first time around, what your view on it is.
It's amazing, really, because I see everything almost as a fresh, so I don't have any of those preconceptions
and judgments.
Yeah, exactly.
That hinder
so,
you, which is yeah. amazing.
I will more pick things that I want to grow based on what I like rather than maybe what's trendy or it's what's known to people. So when I've asked my parents in the past, they've been like, oh, that went out of fashion years ago, but to me it doesn't really matter because
you didn't know it was in the first place and then went out.
yeah it's amazing how these journeys sort of evolve.
Yeah, like dahlias, I suppose. Yeah. Like dahlias were so big once and then they went out of fashion big time.
Yeah.
Didn't they?
Yeah.
But I think with Instagram especially, it's like dahlias have made it back,
exactly,
haven't they?
yeah and I think also looking on the social media channels, there's just so many more plants out there that you find that you wouldn't normally find either, and so
we didn't used to have that opportunity, I guess, because you know I felt completely different to you when I was first getting into gardening when I was 8 or 9 years old. There was a lot of judgment around. I kept it a secret from my school friends. Even I don't think I was a proud plant geek until my early 30s almost. Yeah. So even in my 20s, even when I was working in the industry, I wasn't necessarily chatting about that with friends. There was still a lot of judgment about gardening being unusual. And also, what I carried with me were those preconceptions of like, oh, conifers are dated, heathers are dated. So that's why it's amazing to talk to you. You're coming at it with this really blank canvas. And but did you ever experience any sort of judgment? Because, you know, you got your first allotment, I think, when you were 21. Like, how easy was that to do?
There was actually quite a lot of judgment on the allotment site, because obviously, generally, it's normally older people that are on those sites. So there was quite a lot of criticism, sort of, oh, you're not going to be able to do it, or are you going to grow
Some
flowers?
Negative,
yeah.
Oh,
I remember that when I had my first allotment.
They were like, are you going to fill it with flowers? I was like, no.
Because you're a girl.
Exactly, But and also with, like, friends, a lot of friends don't get it and they still don't get it. Okay. But actually it's quite nice with the social media, like, you know, these pocket friends that you've got, you can talk to people so much on here that have got, like, which I suppose, again, like a decade ago, you might not have had that.
Do you call them pocket friends?
Yeah.
Are we pocket friends?
Yeah.
Well,
that's
people you
so
know
cute.
On social media are pocket friends.
Yeah, that you might not have met in real life, but yeah.
But then you become friends in real life as well, which is so nice.
So are we now pocket friends as well as...
As we could be.
We're pocket plant friends.
Pocket plant friends, that's a good one.
That's really cute. I remember that with my allotment, by the way.
When I first
took it on, exactly the same thing. Almost like, you'll never be able to do that. What are you going to grow? And kind of maybe I was growing in a different way to the traditional way sometimes. And because there's new theories and there's new research and new approaches. And it was like, you'll never be able to grow that. Yeah. And then, of course, they did mostly all grow. And it took a couple of years to be accepted, actually.
Yeah. And I think the other thing was because they said at the beginning, you're just going to grow flowers. I almost didn't grow flowers because of that reason. I didn't want to fall into their stereotype.
Oh.
But actually, how stupid. It was just being young and naive, I think. But now I'm just like, I'll do whatever I want. I'll grow whatever flowers I want. And and again, with fashions and trends and things like that, it doesn't really mean a lot to me as long as I like it.
Yeah.
Which is gardening.
That's the way it should be, shouldn't it, really? Yeah. It's exciting, I think.
I just wish that I was younger now, if you know what I mean, in some ways. Because it feels like it took me longer to get to that stage of kind of, gardening without judgment, really.
Yeah.
But social media, as I always said, has been the lubricant for our industry.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can find fellow plant geeks, people that are interested in that really, subspecies of a plant, really unique stuff. And there's no judgment there, and we're actually connecting with like-minded people. And, of course, sharing what we grow in the garden that might not be the trend, but it might be something that you love that then becomes your own trend.
That's what it's all about. It's what you love, and that's what gardening is brilliant for, isn't it? So with all of the kind of retro plants coming in back around again, it was pinks, that was the other one, pinks, chrysanthemums, all sorts. Have you got a favourite? Have you got a favourite kind of...
Oh, I think the dahlia is my favourite. There's just so many different varieties that have different shapes and colours and patterns, and I just think they're so many of them, the varieties.
Well, if only you knew how people felt about those in the 80s.
Well, exactly. My mum has told me.
In the 80s. Brilliant. Thank you so much. Shall we just lean back and like take in a bit of sunshine right now?
Beautiful day.
Enjoy your allotment.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah. Okay, so can you guys guess where we're standing now? We are standing on an exhibition that we've just been told are going to be the next dahlias. So we're both with Martin from Chrysanthemum Direct. So thank you very much, Martin, for having a chat with us today. And I see your stand. I've seen it at Chelsea and Chatsworth as well. They're always beautiful. They always stand out a mile, don't they? And they do look a bit similar to dahlias, actually, don't they?
Yes, a lot of people get confused between chrysanthemums and dahlias. Yeah. They are very different. They're cousins botanically.
Okay.
So they're in the same plant family.
Right.
But there are vast differences. Dahlias have a tuber, chrysanthemums just have a fibrous root. The stem structure is very different. Dahlias have a hollow stem, which the Incas used to use as water pipes, where they grow naturally in Peru. Chrysanthemums have a more solid stem, and the flowers and leaves are very different.
Okay.
Yeah. But chrysanthemums, we feel, are about to have their time. Is that right?
There's certainly getting to be a lot more popularity in them. Dahlias have had a bit of a revival, and I think chrysanthemums are following on.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think they're next?
I think things go round in circles fashions come and go, as they do with clothes and everything else, and plants are the same. And I think, you know, we do big spectacular displays at all of the flower shows, and I think people are seeing that.
And they think, wow, this is something we can grow and we could maybe achieve. And I think also maybe people are trying to extend the growing season. They want to see flowers, they want to see colour for as long as they possibly can throughout the year. And, you know, now perhaps also with warmer weather a bit later on, that's more possible as well, isn't it? So I think maybe that's why chrysanthemums are also...
Quite possibly. I think they've had a reputation of being hard to grow, but I think once people start growing them, they realise they're actually not that difficult to grow. Yeah. They're no more difficult than any other plant. Yeah. And yes, they do extend the season. And with these days, we don't seem to get hard frosts before Christmas. Mm-hmm. We have customers who have chrysanthemums in flower right up till Christmas in the garden.
Wow.
Okay. So some of these, because to me, it's hard to get my head around chrysanthemums. Some are for indoor, some are for outdoor. Some only flower after a certain time in September. Can you kind of demystify all that for us?
Chrysanthemums are very much autumn flowering, so the earliest ones start flowering September, October, and those will flower quite happily out in the garden, carry on until, till the first sharp frost.
But are they the showy ones you'd use as cut flowers?
There are the big bloom type, the large-headed ones, which, so long as you go for the September flowering ones, are fine out in the garden. Okay. Then there's also the smaller spray ones, which again are fine. The spray ones will go right up till Christmas, as I say, if we don't get a sharp frost outside. There are later flowering bloom ones which don't flower until November, December. Because that's a bigger, heavier flower, they need to come into a cold greenhouse for flowering.
So they're the ones that you see as greenhouse chrysanthemums. And my grandparents were growing tons of chrysanthemums when I was a kid, and that fragrance of chrysanthemum, like foliage and the flower, was a real childhood memory for me. And they were judges as well, and I remember the kind of measuring discs that they used to take to the shows, because, you know, it used to be quite a hot thing to show chrysanthemums and dahlias, didn't it? Yeah, and I imagine that's coming back as well.
Exhibiting, I think, for chrysanthemums and dahlias is falling away. There aren't so many. We're involved quite closely with the National Chrysanthemum Society, and they have very few exhibitors now. People want to grow them in the garden and enjoy them in the garden, but they don't want to put the extra effort in to get an
exhibition. Guys out there on Instagram who are constantly posting the most beautiful photographs of dahlias, as chrysanthemums soon, hopefully, you know, get them out, exhibit them, take them to the local shows, take them to the national shows, because some of them are absolutely beautiful, and that spreads the word, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. We try and encourage people to go to shows and exhibit if they can, but a lot of people just don't want to.
Because it's seen as being a bit more complex to grow, I guess that's the barrier, perhaps, in terms of exhibiting them. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I have got some chrysanthemums on my allotment for the first time because a guy, randomly, who I met in the gym, grows chrysanthemums, and he brought some in for me. I don't know what they are, and I've just planted them out, and they're all doing okay so far, so fingers crossed.
What would be your kind of main tip for chrysanthemums, then, to get them right, or a variety that you particularly love?
I think as a tip, you need to grow them out in the open garden, nice sunny spot, well-drained soil, but a nice rich soil. They like plenty of feeding. Any of the earlier flowering, September flowering sprays, NB weddings, Talbot parades are easy out in the garden. In terms of the bigger blooms, the Aloise series, there's a range of half a dozen different colours. They're very good. And the Misty series, which are exclusive to us, are again are an outdoor bloom and perform very well outside. As a commercial firm, we grow them for cut flower. At one time, we grew 4 acres of those outside, unprotected for the cut flower market. So they do stand up to the weather very well.
I also think one last one I'd like to mention is the Showmaker types. They're the ones that grow into this big football of colour. Are they pretty easy to grow or not? Because you often see lovely pictures of those and they look so unachievable.
There's early flowering ones and late flowering ones with those. The early flowering ones, like the little pot mums, make a 15-18 inch ball, and they're quite easy to grow out in the garden. There are later flowering ones, late charms, which don't flower until November, December. They can make 3-4 feet across if they're grown well, so they need a bit of space and probably need a little bit of protection as well. But
I guess with some of this, it's a race against time, isn't it? You've got to get the growth on a plant that then needs to flower before the frost, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's kind of it's all about timing, isn't it?
Keep your eye on the weather forecast and everything.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Been interesting.
Thank
so you. Let's see your chrysanthemum photographs, everyone at home, then.
So we're here with David from Forest Edge Nurseries, and we're going to find out about the world of heathers. Now, perhaps you've grown heathers in the past, maybe back in the 80s, perhaps even before then, but they've fallen out of favour in recent years. But David's going to tell us why they're back on trend, and there's an amazing amount of new varieties, and they don't all need to be grown in acid, which is incredible. So, David, tell us about your journey with heathers. When did you first become interested, and why?
Well, I was working for another nursery, and one of my jobs there was to propagate and to grow the heathers. And doing that from the age of 19 as an apprentice on a nursery, I then developed a hobby collecting them, collecting the different varieties. There weren't too many about in those days. And then my habit grew into
An obsession.
Yes. That's exactly
perfect
the right
plant geek.
Exactly the right word for it. And now, I mean, we have about 500 different varieties, and that covers the whole range from summer flowering, winter, autumn flowering. So essentially, we've got plants that will grow and flower right through the whole year. Even in the winter months, in January, February, March, when really nothing else is too much.
I think they're perfect for that. And isn't that people tend to use them more for that purpose, I think, to fill up, you know, their containers or I've got some on my balcony because they tolerate the dry as well. But generally they are used over the winter months, but they can be used all year, can't they?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's lots of new breeding that's coming in now, and especially for the autumn and winter tubs with the buds and the flowers that don't open fully, and they hold their colour for a much longer period.
Right.
If you've got the winter colour there for three months of the year, right, at least with just the winter flowering heathers, they will grow in most soil types. They're not really fussy at all. And coming from the alpine regions, they're happy with a bit of wind and the rain and the cold weather.
Okay. Hence why they like my balcony, I think, although it doesn't get very wet. And they're not in ericaceous compost either, so is that a bit of a myth?
The winter flowering ones don't need the ericaceous compost. There are some summer flowering ones, a little bit obscure, not normally readily available from the garden centre retail side. Mm-hmm. And those, again, will flower through the summer period, not needing acidic soils at all. Mm-hmm. So, again, with a bit of careful selection and going, and this is where the specialist comes in, and they can give you the advice, not only with heathers but other plants, but find a specialist nursery, and then you can get all the correct information and find plants that you can't readily find.
Why do you think heathers almost fell out of favour? They almost seem to be grouped by some people, similarly to conifers, you know, not seen as cool or trendy anymore. But obviously we're seeing a revival now, but what happened? Why were they looked at in that way?
Well, I think the conifer and heather concept was started really by Adrian Bloom of Bloom's Nurseries.
Oh, I know.
Yes. Back again when I was young, back in the late 70s and beginning of the 80s. And that was the concept there was the low maintenance garden. Mm. So you had the conifers not really needing any maintenance, perhaps just a little clipping or trimming here and there. And the heathers, exactly the same care and attention. All they needed was a light trimming, keep the weed free. And you've got a garden there that really you can sit back and admire without having to sit there and say, oh, yes, this job needs doing and that job needs doing. You can actually enjoy the garden.
That's true. And also, we've actually mentioned Adrian on the podcast a few times before because of his use of conifers and his knowledge and how he uses them at Bressingham Gardens. But it's all of the different textures and the colours, just the same as heathers.
And it doesn't need to be in flower to look good as well.
No, absolutely. Nice. You've got those lovely lime greens and the darker greens and then very silvery foliage as well. So you've got all of that colour, all of that texture for lots of months throughout the year. Mm. So they have been massively underrated, but they are coming around again like so many other plants at the moment. Are you finding that?
Yes, and especially from the wildlife aspect too. And trying to encourage our bees and the butterflies and the other insects. And we even get little frogs and newts amongst our heathers as well. Yeah. So they provide a good environment. It's a fairly dense cover that they've got there and say it's not disturbed very often, and so it's a wonderful environment for them there.
Am I right in thinking as well, because the heathers are flowering a lot of different times a year to summer flowers, that they're useful for bees slightly out of season, either side of summer as well? So they're a useful nectar source?
Yes.
In the cooler months?
Yeah, certainly what we call our winter-spring flowering heathers. Mm. I mean, they're starting to flower in January, February, March. Okay. And if you get a nice warm day, the bees are out there, and you can actually, you don't have to sit and look at your heather bed, you can actually sit there and listen to it. And you can hear the bees humming there. Okay. And that's a very early nectar source for them.
That's interesting.
Very important.
It is so important. And the last time I was at Bressingham was just probably early to mid-spring this year. And there was tons of heather, and it was absolutely full of bees. You could hear it. It was just beautiful. It was beautiful. A couple of us just stopped to look at it. Absolutely swarming with bees. Can I just say, there's some music in the background, which is, you're probably hearing some massive bangs on here. Someone's sound checking behind us, but there you go. Yeah, anyway.
Evening. But you mentioned briefly earlier the heather that doesn't open its buds. Is that the Glamour Girls series that came across from Europe?
Known as the garden girls. Oh, yes, that's right. Yes. So you have to be aware, again, that those flowers aren't going to open and be beneficial to the insects. But they're very much a decorative item, used especially for pots and tubs, produced in the millions, but especially in Germany and abroad.
It's probably the one
abroad.
You see the most for sale in the gardens.
That's right, yes. I mean, they have the purpose there of providing colour for an extended period, because the flower doesn't open, it's not pollinated, it's not fertilised.
So it doesn't open?
No.
How does that happen? It's sterile
It isn't actually sterile, but the buds, the petals and sepals don't actually open, so the insects can't actually access.
Okay, it stays almost like a little balloon, doesn't it?
Like a little bud.
So they can't get in.
They look like little baubles, actually, I think.
Yeah.
Look like tiny little baubles on the stem.
What about the bigger flowered ones you got there? Are they Debosias or something? I'm not sure how to pronounce that word.
Well, it can be pronounced any way you like, from Daboex to Debosia. We say Debosia.
Ah, okay, good.
And this is the Irish. What's commonly known as the Irish heather, and has a much larger leaf, much larger flower as well.
Uh-huh.
And again, a lot of hybridisation gone into these things. We've now got double flowered ones, red, white, purples, dwarfs, talls. So again, going back to the heather, you've got a plant that's suitable anywhere in the garden, from one that may only grow 4 or 5 centimetres to one that will grow 3 metres high if you get to the what we call the shrub or tree heathers.
There's some heathers, or related to heathers, that grow in the rainforest as well, aren't there? Because I've been behind the scenes at New York Botanic Garden and seen some of these ones that kind of hang from the trees, and they're also in the heather families. Crazy world. But like with any of these plants, there's so many relatives that kind of look unlike the norm. I think one of our final questions has to be, how about glitter-covered heathers? How do we feel
about that?
Yeah,
the controversial question.
question.
I think the purest gardener avoids them like the plague. I mean, at one time the coloration was subtle, and so you could mistake them for a real plant. Now the colours have become so vibrant on them. And these, again, are normally what we call the bud bloomers that have this colour.
So we're worried about the glitter because of wildlife and because that's taking away the beauty of the real plant. But if the heathers that are being sprayed are the ones that don't open up, so the bees don't pollinate them anyway, does it matter so much?
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually.
Oh, I don't know. I'm just asking the question.
Depends how much of a horticultural purist you are, I guess.
Yes, yes. There's a fine line between a plastic plant and a real plant that is...
Yeah, at least it's a real plant, so we're halfway there.
That's right.
Yeah. Cool. Okay.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. So now we're with David Lloyd from Ottershaw Cacti. And as you all know, cacti have had a massive resurgence all over social media, massive, huge on Instagram. But you guys have obviously been doing this for a really long time, haven't you?
Yes, a very long time.
So have you noticed like a big change?
Yes, in the last sort of 5 or 6 years, you know, the interest in cacti has become more popular.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, with lots of people wanting to buy bigger plants, you know.
Okay.
So
not just the little mini cacti, they want something big.
Not just the little ones, but you know, sometimes they want the instant effect, you know, so bigger plants are becoming more popular.
Same as out in the garden, actually, isn't it? People want that instant impact, so cacti do the same for indoors, don't they, I guess?
Are people becoming more kind of discerning about the cacti they grow, though? Because in the past, like in the retail stores, they kind of sold as a mixture, but are people buying them by name now?
Very often, yes. Mm. You know, I mean, echeverias are very popular.
Uh-huh.
Aeoniums are very, very popular.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Lots and lots of new varieties coming on the market all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's obviously given people more choice.
Yeah.
So I think that's in sort of enhanced the hobby.
Uh-huh. You know.
And it's like colour and foliage all year round. There's so many variations.
And
you can do so much with them.
When a cactus flowers, that is the most momentous part for me. Isn't it incredible?
It is. A lot of people think that cactus never flower. Yeah.
Or they
have
those
to
little straw flowers are the flowers, don't they?
Yes.
The ones they often stick inside.
The colours you get in the cactus, they're so vibrant.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know, so Sulcury Beauties especially, and Echinopsis are real good ones for colour.
I can see one just in front of us. Can we look at this one here?
It's a sucky
what is? But what is this flower? The flower is beautiful.
This one is Harry Crinkle.
Harry Crinkle. It's a succulent.
It's a cotyledon. It's a succulent. And it has these lovely orange flowers, you know, on a rather tall stem. Mm-hmm.
Do
related
you...
to Kalanchoe, I guess. It looks similar. Quite similar, yeah.
Similar to Kalanchoe. Is there? Have we got a cactus that is flowering right now?
Front,
let's have a little look, shall we? Shall we walk round and have a peek?
Yes.
We'll walk around the front of the stand. There's loads. I mean, it's so colourful, isn't it? So colourful.
While we're on the way, this is Jelly Bean Succulent, a sedum. That was the very first plant that I bought.
Is it really?
Not first succulent, first plant.
Very popular with children, the smaller selections, you know, and they seem to... Children have a sort of a passion, you know, to want to buy a cactus or a succulent.
That was me. Yeah. That was my 8-year-old.
That was
self.
You. And it's come all the way back round again, hey?
But, with the cactus, you know, we have here Mammillaria harleyana. This is, it can be either solitary or multi headed. And it has these lovely sort of purpley pink flowers.
In a perfect ring as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Basically, it looks hairy and it's got little lovely pink flowers on it.
If you were to put your hand onto it, you would find it'll be rather prickly.
Okay. Don't put your hand on it then. Oh, what's this one down here with the big pink flower?
This is Echinopsis rigidissima, Rubris spinus, and they do have plain coloured plants. But this one has the red spines and it has a beautiful deep pink flower.
It's gorgeous. You can just see that that's now about to open up. How long will that flower last for?
Anything up to about 7 days.
Okay.
But weather dependent. If it's very, very hot, you'll get a shorter span on the flower lasting.
Okay. I love the fact that you've got a warning on your stand, warning spiky plants.
You'd be surprised the amount of people that don't take any notice and go, ouch.
Hang on, this one up here has actually got seed setting, hasn't it? It's got seed pods. You see this one here?
Where are we?
Are they seed pods?
Oh, yes, they're seed pods. That's Mammillaria microtheli.
And that seed disease sets easily in the
UK? It does, yes. Oh. If you've got sort of a plant of the same variety together, you know, and you get the bumblebee, you get in the pear, that will fertilise them and you'll get seeds. But the seeds are as pretty as the flowers.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's bright red.
Adds another dimension.
I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, they're so popular now, because there are so many.
Yes.
The flowers and the seed heads and the shapes and the textures, it's quite incredible, yes, really. Like, this display shows that, doesn't it?
It's a real diverse section of plants.
Yeah.
And true cacti are coming from the Americas, and succulents can be found growing all over the world.
Yeah.
Okay. And do you just sell to the public or your wholesale as well?
No, we just do the shows because this is a hobby gone mad.
So, I think plants often are.
Hobby obsession.
A hobby gone mad.
Yep.
That'll be how we intro you.
Yep.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank
you very much.
So have you ever wondered what happens to the plants after a flower show closes its doors? We're here with Tom from the House of Wayward Plants to find out about how they recycle a lot of the plants for flower shows, and also a lot of the plants that don't necessarily make the grade for being on display at the flower show. So hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Hi
Tom. I've always wondered, by the way. I've always wondered what happens, genuinely.
Yeah, you know, we were hoping they just weren't in the skip out the back.
Yeah.
But you're telling us that's not the case, right?
No, it's not the case. We, for the last 4 years, have been rehoming plants from Chelsea Flower Show, and for the last 2 years from Hampton Court Flower Show, and making sure that any of the plants that don't necessarily make the cut in the build-up and might otherwise sort of need rehoming in the breakdown find a good home. And then we give them all on to community gardens and schools all across London, and maybe one day when we take over the rest of the shows, the rest of the UK.
I guess that everyone who exhibits and the show garden designers, they sell off, don't they? So on the last day, there's always a sell-off. Some will go back to the nursery so they can sell them at the nursery. But, like, there's just, like, millions of plants here.
Well, there's always a lot of plants that don't look good enough to sell off or aren't good enough for display. Perhaps they've got broken bits. This is like wonky veg in the supermarkets, isn't it? But in terms of plants and growing plants as well.
Yeah, you know, I've got to just describe kind of where we're sitting, because I think that would be appropriate. I know you'll see it in the photographs, but we're kind of in this little corner, if you like. It looks a bit like Little Shop of Horrors, honestly, but it feels much nicer. So I don't think anything's going to jump out and bite you or anything right now. And then there's like a neon sign behind us that says House of Wayward Plants. It's super cool. So you're trying to make kind of recycling cool, to make people come over to talk to you, that kind of thing?
Yes, we wanted to stand out in a show like this. We're not a plant nursery. We're not just garden designers. We're actually designers by trade. That's how we earn our normal day-to-day jobs. So we wanted to try and stand out a little bit, be a bit fresher. And we were a little bit nervous of the judges, admittedly. But actually, when we had our conversations with them at Chelsea, they really appreciated standing out and being a bit of a fresh face. And it's quite nice to see that a lot of people who've been coming past are starting to be interested in that sort of slightly more designerly line in these spaces as well, because it's a good way of getting younger people involved in projects like this. The RHS is fantastic, but you do notice a slightly aging population. So that's why Hampton Court this year is really exciting, because they've also started calling it a festival.
Okay.
And it's amazing. I've noticed with the 35 and below years, that's really started to encourage a lot more people, like my peers and friends. Like, they're all much more excited about coming this year, whereas previously they might have been a bit hesitant.
I hope they're not waiting for Stormzy to come on, though.
No, definitely not. Genuinely interested in the plant.
That ain't going to happen.
So how exactly does it happen then? People bring the plants to you that are spare, left over, perhaps looking a little bit ugly. And then what do you do? It must be a lot of collation of plants. How do you physically do that?
So, yeah, over the last 4 years, we've developed a still slightly ramshackle system, but it seems to work. We gather a huge amount of volunteers together, and they come down, they meet us on site, and we then send them off with flower trolleys, and we send them around to every stand in the show and basically bug them to remind them that we're here, because their people are so busy at a show like this. They're always a bit like, panic.
So you're like the big plant collectors.
Exactly. Yeah, so we send volunteers off in bright pink hi-vis, and go around and storm the show and basically help people, because we're not just there to collect plants, we are there to sort of act as a bit of respite, but people then donate things actively too. We're not just collecting the dried up ones. People have started to donate in the last 2 years, which is really exciting because they're really beginning to understand what this process is and to know where everything's going, and that's really exciting for us.
We're all becoming far more aware, aren't we, of the environment and what we're doing, and everything we do has some kind of impact, so this is perfectly timed, isn't it? I was going to ask you about all of the black pots. So all of your display, all the plants are in black pots. Is that on purpose, or what's the intention there?
Yes, this year that is on purpose. We noticed at a previous flower show that there were a lot of multicoloured pots, and so we asked why this was, and it's because they are easily detected by the recycling machines. And so what we've done this year is to highlight the hardest to find, the hardest to spot pots, and that is the black pot, because they literally register as blank space. This is something we're still learning about, so we don't know if it's every machine, but a significant amount of recycling waste from garden centres and shows is black pots, because they literally are not registered.
When you buy something from a nursery, most of the pots they come in are black, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I reuse them over and over and over and over again. But
it's because it looks good. The green sets off against the black. The black is the most indiscriminate sort of colour, whereas the Birmingham City Council stand at Chelsea this year, everything was in vivid blue pots.
Yeah.
So it looked very gaudy, but
actually
they were recyclable.
A statement, actually, as well, aren't
Well,
you?
Some of the more marketing-savvy companies in Europe and overseas are starting to put things in very brightly coloured pots. It's kind of branding for the plants as well, so you probably start to see that more and more, which is great for recycling, but not necessarily stylish for everyone.
Oh, well, that's cool. Thank you very much.
Absolute
Thanks,
pleasure.
How do people find you? Are you online or anything?
We are, yeah. If you go to www.wayward.co.uk and follow the little House of Wayward Plants link, it's on there. Also, actually, do you mind if I just plug something
go
a little bit?
It.
Basically,
go
this like this whole project would not be possible at all if it wasn't for the sponsors for this. The National Trust and Barking Riverside London, the RHS and Mordenhall Park, the four partners that we have with this are amazing. And so they don't just donate like time and money, they donate space for us so we can actively make this a thing and physically one-to-one engage with communities, which we just don't get the opportunity to do otherwise.
Okay, well, that's fabulous. Well done. Sponsors, thanks so much. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Nice chilled out day at Hampton Court.
I'm horizontal.
You are horizontal.
On the lawn outside. And yeah, we had to come outside because there's lots of music going on now. And also it's a little bit windy here, so we're hidden at the base of a wall. I feel like we should be accompanied by a posh picnic.
But there's some clover, we might
sadly,
find a four-leaf clover.
We've only got Peppa Pig sweets to entertain us. Four-leaf clover, you've got loads of bindweed. There must be something lucky about
Usually
that.
Usually there's some clover around, but anyway.
Nice
day.
I've never been this near your toes before, Ellen.
You don't want to be. Because
yeah.
Look, what's happened.
What?
My toenail got ripped out. Oh. I was gardening, actually.
Nice colour, is that natural?
Yeah, they're naturally neon pink.
I don't know how girls work.
Unfortunately, you are close to my feet at a stage where they're not looking too good. But anyway.
Well, I'll come back later.
Let's not talk about feet.
Hampton Court. Do you know, I have never been on press day. So this is my first time ever.
On press day?
Yeah. And to be honest, I've only been to the show like a couple of times over the last like 20 or so years.
Why is that?
I don't know. Usually it's a time of the year when I'm a little bit busier. I used to think it wasn't that easy to get to by train, but
it's really easy.
You could go to Hampton Court Station, so
which
hello.
Which is like 5 minutes away.
and I spoke here last year, but only on the Friday on a really hot day, so I was literally just came in and went out again, just did my job and went. But this year's been really nice to have a bit of a wander, really.
I always think it's Hampton's my favourite in that it's so relaxed.
Mm.
And press day's amazing because there's so much space, because the area is so vast.
You've got to remember how privileged we are on
so
press day.
So privileged and feel very, very privileged to walk around in a day like today. And you just get to get close to the gardens, walk through the gardens without queuing for half an hour, you know, get up and close and personal to the exhibits and stuff. So It has a lovely relaxed feel. Mm-hmm. The one thing about Hampton at this time of year is I'm all flower showed out.
Oh, bless you. Well, you're fresh from Norfolk, aren't you?
Yeah. So yeah. I've done so many flower shows and I love Hampton. I'm going to Sandringham in a few weeks just for the day.
But you know what? I think Hampton, always in the gardens, I feel like it's more experimental. Yes, than Chelsea is, which is great.
It is. It's really nice. It's more realistic. It's more relatable. It's a bit more experimental. There's loads of stuff that you can do at home. Mm-hmm. You know, like the grower area where there's all the little plots where they're all growing their own vegetables and stuff. That's so cool.
Really cool.
It's really nice.
And of course, spent lots of time in the floral marquee, kind of tracking down all these retro plants as well, which was pretty ace, and we found some interesting projects there as well. We spoke to a guy that rehomes a lot of the plants that are kind
of cool.
discarded from the shows afterwards, which was quite interesting.
That's really cool because I always wonder where all the plants go afterwards.
Yeah, definitely. So that was great. What else? I don't.
Who did we see? Did we spot anyone famous?
Yeah, I was about to talk about food, but let's talk about people first.
Let's talk about people and food.
No, I don't know.
I only saw Joe Wiley.
Yeah, I got such a man crush on her. No. Girl crush?
Well, I've got a girl crush on her, so you must have a man crush, no?
Yes.
I don't really know.
Conventional crush.
Anyway, she's so cool.
I know, but it's not really a kind of celeb spotting place, which perhaps is why it feels so much more kind of accessible and a bit more kind of organic, really. Because Chelsea is fab, but Chelsea is also a kind of...
Chelsea Press Day is all about celebrities, and it's not like that on Press Day here.
Kind of showy, that's the word.
Yeah. But it's a lovely I would always recommend Hampton to anyone who wanted to go to like their first time flower show.
When I was coming years ago, I was driving here because it is easy to drive to.
Yeah, super easy, and there's free parking.
And you can't park at Chelsea. So.
I like it very much. What was your favourite spot at the show?
I really like the dry garden, the one inspired by Beth Chatto, because I talk a lot about xeriscaping dry gardens, using gravel, using drought-tolerant plants. And here it was as a showcase, like very soon after you walked in, and it looked just absolutely resplendent. Cool word, huh?
Resplendent. Gosh.
And so many cool plants in there, and this is a zero maintenance garden, and people don't realise that concept exists, and it can be done.
It can be done.
So it's very educational. Yeah, I loved it. Yeah, and it's got it's really kind of the premiere spot for a garden because it's got the palace behind it as a backdrop, so you can't help but get it in your photos.
And you did get plenty.
Yeah, exactly. What about you though, darling?
Okay, so there wasn't a plant that kind of really stood out, although I do like rose hot chocolate.
Oh yes,
that's a really nice rose. So it's redy browny.
Yeah, it's a really cool
rose. That's a really nice rose. So I spotted that, which I really like.
Doesn't smell of chocolate.
It doesn't smell of chocolate, no. But it's a lovely, lovely, lovely colour. I think for me, to be honest with you, I love all the grow your own area. But as we were sort of walking over that way, we saw the school gardens. Mm-hmm. And I genuinely love seeing what the kids are creative. They're so creative. Like, we have barriers to our creativity.
Yeah, you're right.
As we get older. And kids don't. And it's colourful and it's fun. And you just think there's some really innovative stuff going on in those tiny little spaces.
And it's nice the way they kind of think about that stuff as well.
Yeah,
which
it's
is
all
great.
Recycling and reusing and growing your own edible flowers and stuff, and I just think that's really nice to see.
But that's like when we talked to, also in this podcast, we talked to Hayley from Hayley's Allotment.
Yeah, she's so cool.
And it was so interesting because she doesn't have that kind of barrier to what she believes in the gardening world because she hasn't been around as long as us. So kind of, we've kind of been there when gardening was something that was judged and horticulture wasn't a career that you would willingly get into. So it's great that these younger people don't have those restrictions on themselves.
They just get
amazing.
On with it. It's really, really good. I definitely think
love that.
Since I kind of came into the industry, I suppose, things have changed. They have changed. I know we're constantly talking about getting new people or young children more interested in gardening, but I think that is happening. There's much more to be done, but that is happening. You only need to see this stuff here.
Well,
to show it.
When we're chatting to the guy at Ottershaw Cacti, you know, he's telling us that kids are buying their dinky little succulents, and that
cool,
is
isn't it?
Excellent. So
can
brilliant.
I just say, I can't take my eye off your dingly dangly
earring. Oh, why? It's a cross. I got a new earring, but I think I should get a little trowel.
A little trowel?
Do you think you can get trowel earrings?
Yeah, I bet you can.
Yeah?
Yeah. A little gardening earring.
I get a trowel and a fork the other side. thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Plant Based Podcast.
Have a browse of the rest of the library or hop on over to the website, which is theplantbasedpodcast.net.
You'll also find our social media links. Please connect with us and let us know about any plant-based projects that you think we should be covering on the show.
And make sure you subscribe to our podcast so you'll be the first to hear the next episode. We're releasing once a fortnight. So until next time, enjoy the world of plants.